You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, George and Lena Saunders are two Oklahomans whose names are mostly lost to history. But in our state's early history, my guest today says they were two foundational figures upon which Oklahoma's later civil rights movement would rest. The Saunders of Chandler were an anomaly in segregated Oklahoma in the early days of statehood. In the 19-teens and 20s, the Saunders lived the American dream to an extent unimaginable to most African Americans of the era. They were wealthy, but they also interacted with both white and black communities in their hometown of Chandler and throughout the state. George Saunders was at one time Justice of the Peace in Chandler and owned a business right in the heart of Main Street. Lena Saunders was a teacher in its segregated school, Douglas. Both were active in the pre-civil rights empowerment and educational movements led by W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. Local historian Hannibal Johnson writes about this couple and about life in Oklahoma for African Americans during the pre-civil rights era in his book, The Saunders of Chandler, a pioneering power couple in pre-civil rights Oklahoma. And he joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Hannibal Johnson, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
So tell us about this journey you took into the early pre-civil rights history of Oklahoma and this couple from Chandler, George and Lena Saunders. Who are George and Lena Saunders and why are they important in Oklahoma's history?
So I happened upon Lena Saunders sort of by chance, and I believe it was at a library in Norman. Lena Saunders was a very physically attractive woman who wore elegant clothes, and she was very photogenic. So there are photographs of her in ornate gowns and beautiful hats, well coiffed, and there was a collection of photos about Lena Saunders. So I said, who is this woman? I began to learn about her. She was a really prominent educator, taught at Douglas School, the all-black school in Chandler. She actually ran teachers institutes at Langston during the summers. So I wanted to sort of know more about Lena Saunders. So I delved into her history, and I happened upon an equally compelling history of her husband, George Saunders. Lena Saunders died in 1949. George Saunders died in 1924. So because of her relatively longer span, we know more about her. But I wanted to know about them as a couple. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of how I happened upon this book. And also, it's important, I think, for us to think about the foundation that was laid for the people that we know as civil rights heroes and heroines from the 50s and 60s. They didn't operate in a vacuum. There were people who did a lot of work before they came around. George and Lena Saunders are a couple of those people.
So give us an idea of how they sort of laid the foundation. As you mentioned, Lena was, you saw these pictures, she was always well-dressed. That was because the family was fairly wealthy at one point. George was a very successful cotton broker, right?
He was a cotton broker. He was a lawyer. He mm-hmm. served as Justice of the Peace. He was on a bank board. He owned several other businesses. He taught at one point at Douglas School in Chandler. He was really a Renaissance man who did all manner of things and became really prominent, hobnobbing with territorial governors and later Oklahoma state governors, and just really being on the scene and on point at all times. He was actually appointed to the Race Relations Commission after the 1921 Tulsa race riot. Governor Robertson appointed him to that commission.
Really? And so, you know, when we think about that, when we think of Oklahoma, one of the first acts it passed as a state in 1907 was Jim Crow laws. And yet here's this man who's moving between the worlds of black Oklahoma and white Oklahoma fairly easily. Or was it that easy?
It's sort of doubly ironic as well, because both George and Lena Saunders were very fair-skinned African-Americans. In fact, people often mistook them, particularly George, for a white person. And so they affirmatively chose to live their lives as black folks, right, on the other side of the proverbial racial divide. So they became sort of bridges between the black and white communities because of the respect that they were accorded, in part because of their accomplishments, but perhaps made a little bit easier because of their physical appearance, their physiognomy.
How much should we put into that? Do you think that, I have to feel that was probably pretty important.
I think it was
in working in white circles at that time.
I think it was important, and we know that even today in 2018, colorism is a reality. Mm-hmm. So we can hear all manner of stories from black people who happen to be of a fairer complexion and have more Eurocentric type features, that their lives are sometimes less difficult because less stressful because of their physical features.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the days of passing are, I suppose, lessened now, if not over. But I mean, for people who were ambitious at that time, I think the temptation would have been great, wouldn't it?
I wonder how many of our listeners really know what passing is. And so Passing is a phenomenon whereby people who were African-American, because the general rule was the one drop rule, right? Yeah. So if you had any African-American blood, you were considered black. But there were a number of people, including, for example, Walter White, who's the executive secretary of the NAACP, who had sort of blondish hair and blue eyes, but he had black blood in his lineage, and he was considered black, and he lived his life as a black man. So there were some African-American people who could pass for white. There's a danger, but the danger is that you're discovered, and then you're punished for passing. But there were African-Americans who did pass for white. George and Lena Sonner happened to be on the other end of the spectrum. They affirmatively chose to live their lives as black folks and to live their lives in service of the black community.
I think you tell one story in the book about a railroad conductor wondering why white people would willingly go sit in the African-American section of the segregated railroad station.
Right. There was even one incident where George Sonner was traveling with one of his friends who was black. And the friend decided to play a joke on George. They were in a rail car. The friend called the conductor back to the rail car and said, "You need to remove this white man. He's bothering me." So the conductor literally removed George Sonner from the rail car, thinking he was a white man sitting, for whatever reason, in the Negro section.
But the main emphasis of your story is this remarkable story of these two pioneers in a way. What do we know about George Saunders? You said we know less about him. How did you go about digging up his story?
Mostly newspaper articles chronicling his life, but some other documents, like, for example, a receipt for his contribution to the National Negro Business League, which is a black chamber of commerce that was set up by Booker T. Washington. Documents like that.
How hard was it to really get the details of who these people were and about their life? I mean, other than newspaper articles, you know, I mean, black newspapers will obviously be writing about them significantly, but were white newspapers writing about them?
That's one of the things that's really interesting about the Saunders. Because they were so prominent in the Chandler community, and Chandler was kind of a racial oasis at the time, they were so prominent that the white newspapers reported really favorably about them. I can give you an example. This example is George Sonner's obituary from 1924, and it was published in a newspaper called the Chandler News Publicist on May 2nd, 1924. Let me just read that. And it says, "The passing of George Sonner. The people of Chandler and the community roundabout were shocked and saddened at the news of the passing of George Sonner, whose death occurred at his family residence in East Chandler on Thursday morning. Mr. Sonner had been in failing health for many months, but he was such an uncomplaining nature that his closest friends didn't know of his condition, and for that reason, his demise was a distinct shock to the city and the community. There's no language at our command by which we can fittingly portray the sincerity of regret with which his hundreds of friends express his passing. He was one of the most unique and influential characters in this section of the state, and one of the most trusted and outstanding men of his race in Oklahoma."
Wow.
That's just a sampling from that obituary in the Chandler News Publicist from 1924. Again, this is a white newspaper reporting on the death of a black man in extraordinarily glowing terms.
You mentioned Chandler's in Oasis in Oklahoma, say in the 19-teens and 1920s. Obviously, we know of all the turbulence around the country after the First World War, of course, culminating in events like the Tulsa Race Riot and many other events like that around the country. But you said Chandler was a relative oasis. What was it? What did you find about Chandler that was different?
Well, by most accounts, George and Lena Sonner really played a role in creating this harmonious community. Chandler's a relatively small town. Population of Chandler now is about 3,000. Chandler, by the way, is about 60 miles southwest of Tulsa on I-44. So, but they actually played a great role in building relationships with folk in Chandler and creating this kind of live and let live that was unusual at the time in Oklahoma. We know, for example, that the first act of the Oklahoma legislature, Senate Bill No. 1, was a bill that rigidly segregated the state. We know that there were lynchings in Oklahoma, as there were in other places. We know about the 1921 Tulsa Race Riot. This is a really, really difficult period, not just in Oklahoma history, but in our nation's history around the issue of race. So it's really remarkable. I want to read one other thing. And this is a letter of recommendation for Lena Sonner, who, again, was a prominent teacher. The letter is interesting for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that it was penned by James Robertson, who was a lawyer in Chandler and went on to become governor of the state of Oklahoma. Here's what he had to say. He said, "The bearer of this letter, Mrs. Lena Sonner, is principal of our colored schools and has occupied this position for several years. And coincidentally, she would likely continue in her present position so long as she desires. She's a very successful teacher and has the love and respect and exercises the most perfect control of her pupils. She is an exceptionally well-educated woman, and her reputation for morality and high ideals, good citizenship, etc., is of the very best. She is capable of holding a chair in any of the higher institutions of learning. She is entitled to the most favorable consideration of your honorable board, to whom I am informed she is making application for a life certificate. Any favors shown her will be duly appreciated, and I'm sure no one will ever have cause to regret any aid they may render this deserving teacher."
Mm. Now, that school she was teaching at, she helped found, right?
Right. It's Douglas School, the black school in Chandler, which grew after she began to teach there in 1902. And she taught there until 1934. She became ill. She ultimately went blind. Mm-hmm. But she lived until 1949.
Yeah. Now, was Chandler different than a lot of Oklahoma towns? I was thinking a lot of these Oklahoma towns, they did not allow African American people to live within the town. That's why we have black towns just outside of a lot of the major county seats in a lot of the eastern part of the state. Was that the case in Chandler?
It's interesting because you're talking about sundown towns.
Yeah.
Norman, where the University of Oklahoma is, was a sundown town.
Right.
So you could be black and be in Norman during the daylight hours, but there were signs in a lot of these sundown towns that said, "Don't let the sun set on you, expletive, here," and to be out of town before the sun sets. And so Chandler was different in that respect. So black people lived in the city limits of Chandler. Actually, the Sonners had a business on Main Street in Chandler, which makes it all the more remarkable.
Really?
Now, in terms of the county, in Lincoln County, there were black enclaves that spread.
Was Boley nearby?
Boley was fairly close. George Sonner had a cotton gin in Boley and was known prominently in Boley as well.
Yeah. So what do we know about their early years? Were they did they come to Oklahoma at statehood? Had they been born here? What do we know about them?
Interestingly, George Sonner was born 5 or 6 years before the Civil War. Mm-hmm. So he was born into slavery in Mississippi, ended up migrating to Texas for a while, and then coming to Oklahoma during the land openings. Chandler is in the Sac and Fox area.
Right.
And that opened in 1891. So he migrated ultimately from Texas down in up into Oklahoma. Lena Sonner's family was originally from Indiana. They lived for a while in Arkansas City in Kansas, mm-hmm. Lived in Newkirk for a while, and then migrated to the Chandler area.
Yeah. And he was able to build a number of businesses, obviously.
He was. He was really, really successful and kind of entrepreneurial, which I think raises another important issue when we're talking about the particular era that was their heyday. During this time, during the early part of the 20th century, there was a prominent national debate in the African-American community that generally was framed on two different sides. One was the W.E. Du Bois side, which talked about political activity and agitation and so forth. And the other side was the Booker T. Washington side, which talks about building skills, being industrial.
Self-reliance.
Self-reliance, mm-hmm. Working, economic focus. And George and Lena Sonner actually split the middle because they were active in civil rights organizations, but they were also active in these economic organizations like the National Negro Business League. So they worked for political engagement and political participation, while at the same time they stressed learning trades, building skills, getting an education, self-reliance, all those sort of things.
My guest today is Hannibal Johnson, a historian. His latest book is titled The Sonners of Chandler, A Pioneering Power Couple in Pre-Civil Rights Oklahoma. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. It's a really fascinating story, not only about the Sonners, but also about what life was like for African Americans in the first 20, 30 years of Oklahoma. And what was that existence like? I mean, I would think it was strict separation from most parts of the state. It would be, well, one of the questions I have about the Sonners was, how did they get access to capital in a time when, to build businesses at a time when most African Americans were probably denied that routinely?
That's a very interesting question. I think the answer lies in the phenomenon that happened here in Tulsa on Black Wall Street. So you have essentially Black people creating their own insular economy and benefiting from engagement one with another, since they were cut off essentially from the larger economic sphere. And that's kind of what happened with George Sonner and Lena Sonner. Lena Sonner was teaching in a Black school. She became principal of the Black school. George Sonner was a businessman, very entrepreneurial, but he had a cotton gin in Boley. Boley was one of the all-Black towns. It's an all-Black town because of segregation and because of the economic opportunity it creates for Black people to be successful in business.
But it sounds like those lines were at least blurred in Chandler at some point because he had a business on Main Street.
Yeah, Chandler's unusual in that regard. And he also became justice of the peace, which would be unusual as well. So this is, I think it's a really encouraging story about early Oklahoma that we should teach, but we don't teach. So people don't know who the Sonners are, and don't understand that the people that they do know about, perhaps Ada Lois Scipio Fisher, perhaps Clara Looper, really stand on the shoulders of people like the Sonners.
Yeah. Now, Chandler was not an oil boom town, was it? Or was it at one point?
Chandler prided itself on its cotton. Cotton was the king in Chandler at the time.
Yeah, and I assume with cotton fields, the African American population, a lot of that was the workforce at one point.
Absolutely. And Lena Sonner, despite her refinement, she did a lot of charity work. And one of the things she did some summers would be to go and work in a cotton field with some of her students picking cotton and donating the money to charities like the Red Cross.
Wow.
And we actually have rare Benny Kent film footage of Lena Sonner picking cotton, the money from which was donated to the Red Cross.
Yeah. Now, you said the people we assume as being civil rights pioneers in the state are really standing on the Sonners. What was their engagement with what, at that point, I don't even know if they were even calling it civil rights at that time, in the early teens and 20s. What were you know, this idea of being politically engaged, was that the goals at that point? Was it a political engagement? Was it, what were the goals at that particular time?
So most of the engagement really fell on the shoulders of George Sonner, and he was engaged with a number of other black men who met in various groups, really to share information, to promote solidarity, to donate money to causes, to promote black participation in the political sphere, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So as I'm sure you, at one point you wanted to see what their involvement with what early 20th century civil rights were. What sort of things did they do other than raise money? Was that the main thrust?
Well, as I mentioned, George was on the Race Relations Commission that was set up after the 1921 Tulsa Race Riot, because the Tulsa Race Riot, of course, became a matter of statewide interest. People were concerned about the state of race relations, concerned enough at least for the governor to set up a commission and to realize that George Sonner had a network and was influential enough to really deserve a seat on that commission.
Do we know how he contributed to that, or are the records lost at this point?
I don't know any specifics other than he did actively participate and go to the meetings that were held.
Now, you mentioned Lena Sonner, in addition to teaching at the Douglas School, you said she was also involved with Langston. Was there a big connection with Langston, since that's not too far away?
Yes. She actually was such a prominent teacher, was held in such high esteem that she was hired by Langston to sort of do train the trainer or teach the teacher sessions during the summer at Langston University, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah. Well, as you spent more time with them, what really struck you as the most important thing that average Oklahomans need to know about a family like the Sonners?
I think just knowing that they existed, first of all, that there's a foundation that was laid for us by people who spent time and really sacrificed to make things better for all people of color and by extension for all people in the state.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when we think of families at this time, we really think of, you know, and it probably was impossible for people of that era to rebel against the status quo. In many ways, it was about making the best of a situation in the status quo. Is that the case, you think?
Interesting. Let me give you an example about kind of subtle rebellion, something that Lena Sonner did that was really noteworthy. She taught it at Douglas School, which was the black school, and on occasion, some of her students would be taunted by whites in the town as they left school and walked through town to their homes. When word would come back to Lena Sonner that this was happening or this might happen, she would gather her students on some days at the end of the school day, and she would parade them through Chandler with her at the head of the parade, wearing her dress and her heels and with her hair coiffed and perhaps a hat, as really a sign of defiance.
So marching in line.
Marching with her students saying, uh-huh, we are here. We are not going anywhere. Deal with it.
Oh, interesting.
And that was her way, rather than engage in any kind of harsh rhetoric or any physical altercation, her way was just a symbolic march through town with her students.
Which in that day and age would have...
That's a big deal.
Yeah, it was a big deal, and anything more probably would have ended in disaster.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. I see you have a page open to Lena's Laws, which you write about in the book.
You know what? I think it's important to understand her philosophy of education. And these are, I've sort of labeled these Lena's Laws. And I want to share them because they're incredibly relevant today, because we're working still on equity in education. Think about her rules, her laws, as they applied then. This would be early part of the 20th century. Number one, if they apply themselves, all children can learn. Number two, worthwhile education has to be holistic. So that includes learning about both the academic and the practical. For example, studying mathematics and science is academic. Honing social skills is practical. Black children need to be provided with role models and imbued with a sense of pride in order to achieve educationally. Number four, a school is a part of a community. The school must support the community. The community must support the school. Teachers must be able to relate not just to the students, but to the families of those students as well. Number five, teachers must be motivated and highly qualified. And number six, students need to understand the role of competition in society and know how to compete. So those are the principles by which she educated her students. And a lot of those principles sound like principles that would be applied in the modern day community schools movement. It's a holistic model, engage the students, but engage the parents, engage the community, draw on resources, leverage capacity.
Sounds like a lot of what things we're trying to do today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's still a challenge as it was a challenge back then.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting book, The Saunders of Chandler, a pioneering power couple in pre-civil rights Oklahoma. Fascinating story of a couple that played an important role and on the verge of being lost to history in many ways. Did you run any people who knew the Saunders?
I was hoping you'd ask that question.
Yeah.
So I interviewed a couple of people who knew Lena Sauner because, again, she lived until 1949. Yeah. One of the people I interviewed was George Sauner Ellis. This is a man who's in his 90s now and lives in Virginia. He was a student of Lena Sauner's. His mother, Maggie Ellis, was Lena Sauner's best friend. The Ellis family had 10 children. George Sauner Ellis was born just after the death of George Sauner and was named for him. Truly remarkable.
Yeah. What did he have? What did he have any interesting?
He spoke of her in really glowing terms. He just remembered how refined she was, what a perfectionist she was, that she left a lasting impression on him and all of his siblings who went to Douglas School.
Yeah. Well, interesting book. The name of the book, Saunders of Chandler. Hannibal, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Local historian Hannibal Johnson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa about his latest book, The Saunders of Chandler, a pioneering power couple in pre-civil rights Oklahoma. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Rigsby at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.